Stephanie Lynam is the Chief Clinical Officer at Homes for the Brave. And Stephanie, welcome to WICC. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you so much for having me, Melissa. I'm really excited.
Yeah, so I was excited when I first got to meet you, Stephanie. And tell people, if they've never really heard of, first of all, what a Chief Clinical Officer does. What is it exactly that you do in relation to veterans for Homes for the Brave?
Sure. So my job, there was nobody in my position before they brought me on in 2019. And Homes for the Brave saw that there was this expanding need for mental health services that just weren't being fulfilled within the community and the VA because veterans were having a difficult time accessing those services. And so they brought me on. And at that time, I began to oversee all of our programs to ensure that staff had what they need so we could provide the quality services that our veterans and clients deserve. I also ensure that I'm up to date with the research and the trends in the housing and mental health field so that we can adapt our programs as needed to match those trends as we learn more information over time.
So
expansion? Go ahead.
Nope. Keep going. I want to hear more.
I was going to say, and you know, in any expansion of any programs that we've done over the years, a lot of has been under my auspices. So our new annex and our expansion in clinical services within the past 2 years, and taking on our new transitional houses, I've overseen that as well.
So the thing I was going to ask you, Stephanie, is in the last couple of years, we've had such a focus on mental health, as you know. And one of the things that I learned just from talking to Vince Santilli earlier this week was that mental health has been an issue for veterans well before the pandemic ever was a thing. Talk to us about some of the needs or the issues that are brought to your office.
Sure. So a lot of it is, you know, a reaction to systems issues and a lack of access to those services. Because when somebody's in need and experiencing depression or anxiety or substance use issues, they don't necessarily see the need themselves first. And it's difficult to get in. Right now, there's not a lot of providers out there that provide individual therapy. A lot of our systems right now offer medication management and offer group therapy, which are wonderful opportunities to get some help, but that's not for everybody. And it can be really intimidating when you've never accessed those services before. And so the wonderful thing that Homes for the Brave did was hiring me so that there was a clinician right there in the house so our residents get to know me, and then I can talk to them, and I'm a known person, and say, why don't you just come in and sit down and, you know, like, let's have a conversation. So it's a lot less intimidating than signing up for group therapy or individual therapy, especially if someone's never accessed those services in the past.
I mean, how intimidating is that, though, Stephanie? I think about even just in general when people are going through hard times and you say, you know, maybe you want some help, maybe you want to talk to somebody, just the everyday average person. And at first, not everybody will react with, oh, yeah, that sounds great. Let me get a therapist. I mean, I think you and I both know most people are going to say, yeah, no, it's not for me. I'm not someone who falls under that category, whatever that category is. And I think it's got to be even more intimidating when you think about the fact that your past life, you were putting on a uniform. You were known as probably one of the toughest individuals in the human race, in my opinion. I think people who have become part of the military and have defended our honor and our freedoms, they are kind of seen as like the strongest people. They're superheroes, right? So the idea of them then wanting to get help or needing help, it sounds ironic and not in a good way. So it must be really hard for them to try and approach the idea of let me get help for my mental health.
Absolutely. And also the culture. I mean, there were so many years that if you stepped up and even had the courage or awareness that you needed help within the military, then you lost your job. You were kicked out of the military.
Right.
And so there was high stakes at hand. You know, when you think the stigma in our country around mental health has definitely gotten better, but we still have a long ways to go to make it very normalized that, you know, anybody can benefit from therapy and talking to someone.
So we're chatting with Stephanie Lynam this morning, who is the Chief Clinical Officer at Homes for the Brave. Stephanie, we were talking about mental health needs for veterans and how difficult it can be to come and say, hey, you know, I'm struggling with this, or I feel like I'm in a dark place or depression or whatever it could be, to go and get help. Do you find that the veterans you end up working with, were they initially coming to you for help, or is it family members, loved ones who are reaching out and saying, hey, I'm worried about dad, I'm worried about my husband, I'm worried about my wife, I'm worried about my daughter? Which do you see more? Which scenario?
Well, I think in this setting, working at Homes for the Brave, it's usually more the veteran, but they're usually coming to me for, a different need. They maybe have been denied a service connection claim for benefits at the VA, and so they want to understand why. And so I'll work with them around like a specific task or thing that they're looking for help with, and then they get to know me, and we start working on their mental health over time. But other times, it really is at the urging of family members and friends or a case manager that's worked with them. And so they might come in and say, everyone's telling me I need to, meet with you, or I need help, but I don't really see it, and then we'll talk about that and help engage them in the process to help them see maybe what others are seeing.
What do you see? Because I think that's really interesting. So they're coming in for a whole different purpose, and then you kind of pick up on some things. Like, could you give us an example without naming names, of course? What are some of the things you pick up on, and what are some of the commonalities you find with some of your clients?
Yeah, so I think a lot of it is that these individuals have learned to survive over the years, and so they're not even seeing the difficulties themselves. They're attributing it to other factors, let's say. So, they might be externalizing it, saying that it's the people around them causing these difficulties with their relationships, why they can't have a healthy romantic relationship when that's all they really want, or they're arguing with their family members and they can't live with them anymore, and they don't see how their substance use and their depression that's underlying that is really contributing to the relationship issues that they're seeing. I would say that's probably the majority of what we see.
Interesting. And it is a really neat way of handling it, because you kind of come at it from at first, like, hey, they're coming to you as a resource, like, listen, this is going wrong for me. So you have this business relationship, but after a few times of meeting, they now get to know you and they're comfortable with you, that you feel you can approach them with, hey, I've noticed this, can we talk about it? I mean, how frequently do veterans then feel comfortable coming to you? Or do you have a lot who say, you know what, I appreciate you caring, Steph, I really like you as a person, but therapy's not for me?
More often than not, they do feel comfortable. And the nice thing about this program is then I'm also able to see them for therapy even after they leave our residential program.
Really?
It's separate, yes. So we can start that relationship and start working on the therapy while they're living in our houses. And then if they live locally or they choose to, they can continue to see me for therapy when they leave.
And you don't charge them?
So we do some like pro bono if mm-hmm. they can't afford it. We also do charge insurance to pay for their services as well.
That's amazing. So, Stephanie, if anybody is not with Homes for the Brave, if we have a veteran listening this morning, but they are not homeless, they live at home, but they're like, hey, this woman seems like the real deal. Can they contact you?
Absolutely. And we also just this past couple weeks ago hired a full-time therapist, and so she has openings as well. So if anybody listening is interested in learning more about our mental health services or therapy with us, they can call the main Homes for the Brave number at 203-338-0669, or they can also call our new location, the Annex, which is also in downtown Bridgeport, at 203-275-0600.
And is it only one-on-one therapy, or do you offer group therapy?
So right now we are offering one-on-one therapy for veterans and their family members and children. And we hope to expand to group therapy, but right now we're in the process of looking to see what are the group therapy needs, because a lot of agencies in Bridgeport already provide group therapy. And so we don't want to duplicate that. We are doing a needs assessment to see, are there other types of therapy out there that nobody else is providing, so then we can create that within our center.
Interesting. Well, I thank you so much, Stephanie, and your whole team at Homes for the Brave for what you do for the Brave. And I really appreciate it. And I know our veterans do too, and their families. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa.
Again, that's Stephanie Lynam, and she is the Chief Clinical Officer at Homes for the Brave. And, of course, if you want to learn a little bit more, you can go to homesforthebrave.org. June is technically National Men's month, or health month rather, but November has become what's called Movember. So for nearly 20 years now, Movember has been raising awareness about men's health and their issues every November. In fact, it started with two friends in Australia who use their mustaches to spark conversations about prostate cancer. So you've heard of No Shave November, where a lot of guys will keep their mustaches for the month and they keep it for as long as they can. It raises awareness about cancer, but they've made that movement into something bigger where they just talk about men's health in general during the month of November. So joining us to talk a little bit about this morning, I'm excited to have on the show clinical health psychologist Dr. Valeria Martinez, who's with Tallwood Men's Health in Fairfield. Dr. Martinez, welcome to the show. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me. This is such an important topic to discuss.
It really is. And you know, it's funny, Dr. Martinez, I can't wait to tell you and some of our listeners out there this morning. Just yesterday, we got one of those postcards in the mail from our dentist. And it said to my husband, you know, you're due for your annual checkup. And luckily, the woman who works the front desk and manages all the appointments, she happens to be my son's babysitter. And
oh, wow.
I hand this to my husband and I go, you need to make your appointment for your dentist. You got to go. Now, my husband has like a million crowns and all that. Like he, you know, grew up with not great teeth. And I said, you got to make your appointment. He goes, oh, it's fine. Aggie will just text me. And I'm like, you know what? You're so lucky that the appointment woman is our son's babysitter, because if you have this mentality with everything, I have to book all of his appointments. And I know there are ladies out there who will agree with me. It's hard to get guys to go to their doctor's appointments. Why is that, Dr. Martinez?
Including myself with my husband.
What is the deal, guys? Why won't you go to the doctor? Come on.
You know, I think just men, generally speaking, have a more difficult time, like, receiving help, aid, right? If you kind of think about more of the stereotypical profiles of males, and you, let's say, you know, a wife wants to tell, or a partner rather wants to tell the male partner, you know, something's going on, and they just want support, but the male partner usually wants to fix it, right? Like, that's... So I think they have a hard time kind of being on the, they have a hard time being on the receiving end. So kind of to your point with the scenario with your husband and kind of having the situation where it's more convenient for him, that's kind of the notion of Hartford Healthcare, Tallwood Men's Health. It is a one-stop shop, right? So you go there, you see your urologist, you see your medical surgical weight loss doc, you see your cardiologist, you see someone maybe for sleep, if there's sleep apnea, there's neurology. We have everything under the sun so that men can kind of optimize their health and not have to make all these appointments and go to all these places. It's just in one place.
Okay, so first and foremost, after this call is done, I will certainly be texting my husband to go and check you guys out, because I know he's been looking for just a general practice, like somewhere for him to go just for physicals and things like that, and because he's not originally from Connecticut. So I'll be getting your personal information so that I can just send him there. That would be great. But in the meantime, though, what do you find, Dr. Martinez, you know, what do you find happens for men typically who don't go to their annual appointments, get their physicals done, get screenings done? What are some of the most common issues that men run into as they age?
Well, what's happening is the disease processes that could be found soon or prevented, they are farther along than, you know, they could have been, meaning maybe they become a little bit harder to treat. Men could be kind of suffering in silence, right? And they sometimes feel like that's just normal baseline, when they don't realize they can be feeling much, much better, right? They might be having horrible sleep because they have sleep apnea that's been undiagnosed for years and years. They might have kind of this predisposition to kind of feel a little irritable or angry or sad or anxious. And it's because they might have, you know, clinically significant depression or anxiety disorder that can be treated and they can feel much better. So, you know, I think if they go and have this preventative care, they can kind of prevent these disease processes from happening. And they can really, bottom line, I always tell my patients as a health psychologist, just optimize your quality of life.
Yeah, I like that idea of optimizing your quality of life. Instead of looking at it as like a hounding wife who's like, you got to go get an appointment. You know, I like the perspective of how do you make your life extend further? How do you give yourself the best opportunity to have a better life, feeling better every day and aging properly? I like that. I don't want to call it a spin on it, but I like the way that you said that. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we don't want to sound like we're hounding you guys, but you got to get to the doctor. You just got to do it. We're talking this morning to Dr. Martinez, who is a clinical health psychologist at Tallwood Men's Health in Fairfield. And before we get to the details of where you are, because believe it or not, Dr. Martinez, just in that commercial break, I had two men reach out and go, please, please, please have her say the contact information and the address a few times because we need to write it down. Because I think that one-stop shop model is great. And I don't know how many places offer something like that. You were kind of touching on. Oh, sorry.
Well, it's really rare, actually. It's Hartford Healthcare is a big healthcare system that offers this type of care exclusively to men. So it's not very common.
That's what I thought. I had never heard of something all being under one roof. How long has it been around?
So so Tallwood opened up, I believe, around 3 years ago.
So oh, the wow. Original, so it's relatively new.
Yeah. Well, so this is the thing. The Tallwood, so Dr. Jared Benick is our director, and he's a urologist, and he had this vision for men's health, and he opened up the first site in Farmington. And so that has been up and running for a number of years now, and it really thrived. It thrived so much that now we have our site here in Fairfield that recently opened up over the summer, and it's 1262 Post Road, Fairfield, Connecticut. So we are the second site of Tallwood Men's Health serving the men in the region.
And I know you had said at the top of this, which I will put this on my podcast for those of you who are interested, all the different services. But I did notice in your title was clinical health psychologist. So a lot of times when we talk men's health, I should say, we're talking physical. And I thought at first we're going to talk about things like prostate cancer, so on and so forth. But it sounds like you also talk about the mental needs that men specifically go through.
Absolutely, sir. We're a multidisciplinary team. I am the health psychologist on the team. And as a health psychologist, I focus on helping males, specifically for men's health, kind of cope with medical conditions, help with the illness prevention, like disease prevention. I also treat any sort of psychological conditions such as anxiety, trauma, depression, eating disorders. So I'm able to kind of provide a holistic approach because the mind and the body aren't separate and medicine doesn't work that way. So we're kind of pushing forward in medicine to help people understand that they're together. And psychologists in general are becoming more co-located on site with physicians.
I think this is incredible. So, Dr. Martinez, what everybody is waiting for, one more time with the location. Also, if you have a website, if you've got a phone number, anything you can offer to our listeners. I literally have guys reaching out to me right now saying, wait, the fact that this is a one-stop shop, I can almost make my own appointment. So I would love to get that information out there.
Absolutely. So it's hartfordhealthcare.org/menshealth. HartfordHealthcare.org/menshealth. And the new Fairfield site is 1262 Post Road, Fairfield, Connecticut. And you can give us a call at 860-678-5700. 860-678-5700. And the nice thing also about our Tallwood Center is that we have something called nurse navigators. So just because we understand how men work and they kind of need that extra help in like making appointments, we have that point person. Our nurse navigators are there to kind of schedule everything, ask about symptoms, refer out, explain what the appointments are. And we have specifically a very fantastic one. Her name is Mary Kuchman, and she would be happy to extend her help to the men in the region.
That's fantastic. So again, if you missed that, it is on the Post Road in Fairfield. It's called Tallwood Men's Health. And the website is hartfordhealthcare.org/menshealth. And I wrote down the number so that I could text it to my husband. It's 860-678-5700. Dr. Martinez, I want to thank you so much for your time this morning, and thank you for being part of this team. And I look forward to hopefully getting my husband an appointment really soon. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Good to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. Bye-bye. And again, that is Dr. Martinez. She is a clinical health psychologist over at Tallwood Men's Health in Fairfield. Relatively new center. It's a one-stop shop, basically, for men's health. So, ladies, if you've got a man in your life or a son in your life or somebody who you're like, listen, I just got to get them to a doctor. They've got to check for X, Y, and Z. This is kind of a no-brainer, I think. It's Tallwood Men's Health in Fairfield. That's the second location to open. The first one was in Farmington, but it's relatively new, and they are taking appointments, 860-678-5700. So yesterday morning, I was bringing attention to the Milford police standoff situation and the fact that it really wasn't in the news that much, other than the initial day when that 911 call came through. And 3 days later, they were able to handle the situation. And so as I was talking about it on my show, Gary McNamara called in, and Gary was calling, who is the former chief of police in Fairfield. He also currently works at Sacred Heart. And we have Gary on the show pretty often, so a lot of you are familiar with him. But he made a quick comment, and I was like, we need to dive into this a little bit more, especially because you have a professional perspective of standoff situations that could go very well, like it did in Milford, and some that don't go well. They go terribly wrong. So, Gary, welcome back to the show. Thank you for coming on the next day. I really appreciate that. And I appreciate having you this morning. Good morning. Let's see, Gary. Hold on. There you are. Sorry, Gary. I couldn't hear you. Hello.
That's okay. Hello. Thanks for having me back on. And it's always good to dive in. Sometimes we overlook some of these incidents that happen or whatever. We don't really dive in with conversation just to give those different perspectives on how things develop. So thank you for having me back.
Oh, no, not a problem at all. So as I mentioned, you know, Gary was the former chief of police in Fairfield. And before you went to Sacred Heart and even before you became a chief, Gary, how long were you pretty familiar with active kind of standoff situations or how long have you been a cop for? That's probably a good way to start this.
Yes. So, you know, I was 30 years as a police officer, and at one point I was a negotiator with the Fairfield Police Department. So I negotiated a few incidents, my first one being the one at Fairfield University where a classroom was held hostage way back in 2002. So I have a little experience in it. And, you know, certainly as a chief, you always want to prepare and make sure you have the right staff and personnel and resources for when these incidents do arise. You want to make sure you're prepared to handle them.
What is that like, Gary, being a negotiator? And do most police forces have negotiators on staff?
So I think most do. You know, there's varying degrees. So if you look at a police officer when they go through the academy, they're given skills. And, you know, we're really behavioralists at heart, meaning that we always influence behavior, whether we want to or not. Police officers always change behavior for the better or for the worse. So even in the academy, you get some level of training on how to de-escalate and have conversations and how to actively listen to people. And then we have officers who are crisis intervention team members. So they get higher level to try and, you know, talk to people who are in some sort of an emotional crisis. And that dives right up to a crisis negotiator level where you have somebody on staff or maybe several people on staff who can respond to these incidents where someone's in crisis, not wanting to leave their house, maybe holding people against their will, or maybe an individual who is suicidal and in a position where they can do themselves harm. You always want to have somebody there that can assess the situation, stabilize it before you resolve it. You always have to stabilize the incident before you can resolve it.
So I asked that question about being a negotiator, which I would imagine meant extra training. I don't know for sure, but did it take extra training?
It did, yeah, a lot of training. Some training with some federal agents, some state agencies, and then, you know, ongoing training amongst the crisis negotiators throughout the region. They always kind of train together. They look at incidents around the country. They debrief them. How would we handle it? And then they train together as a team. You know, the crisis negotiators are one component of a response to a type of incident that occurred in Milford. You'd have an initial patrol response. You'd gear up try to get as much information as you can, bring out resources that can stabilize the scene, get up a barrier around the scene to prevent somebody from, you know, going into the area. And then you call out resources, whether it be an ERT or a SWAT team, what people mostly think about, and then some negotiators that can start a dialogue with the individual inside the residence.
So we're talking to Gary McNamara this morning, former chief of police in Fairfield. And the reason I was asking about a negotiator is then why are there so many talks about adding social workers to police departments if we have officers who have done extra training to become negotiators?
Well, because, you know, social workers bring an element that maybe negotiators do bring. But, you know, negotiator is a skill and really an art form. And so they're trained and they would come out for specific incidents. And now they're on patrol, and whether or not they can't necessarily respond to every incident. So if you have somebody that is outside the law enforcement realm but connected to law enforcement who can respond to those scenes and bring a perspective, or in the view of the individual in crisis, they're not talking to a police officer. They're talking to somebody else who's trained, who can come along. We've done it in the past in Fairfield when I was chief. We bring in Bridgeport Mental Health periodically. So we have resources on hand that say, hey, we need to bring in some assistance to try to stabilize the incident and bring resolution or resolve the incident for the person in crisis.
So I think I've made it very clear with this story that I'm incredibly impressed with Milford Police. So I don't want this next question to be seen as anything other than I am just asking almost like devil's advocate. To some extent, Gary, though, in this situation that happened in Milford, did Milford just kind of get lucky that they had a person who was not violent, or at least could recognize that there was something violent in him? Because when you talk about things going wrong versus going right, sometimes I would think circumstances have a lot to do with that versus the police's actions. Or do you disagree? I don't know.
Well, you know, it's not like they just packed up and left. You know, what they did was they downsized their response. So while it might appear that they, you know, everything went back to normal, certainly in the eyes of the Milford Police Department, it did not. And those decisions are not taken lightly. Once they respond to that incident, you know, they respond with very little information. Maybe it's I have a gun, I'm going to hurt myself or whatever. They respond. They get as much information as they can. And then they bring in negotiators who I'm sure have had conversations with the individual, or they've gotten information one way or another that they understand that by them being there in such force, it is escalating the incident. It's not stabilizing and beginning to resolve the incident. So they make those decisions. They don't take those decisions lightly. You know, why would they? They're not just going to say, ah, forget it, he'll come out when he comes out. They're basing it on the information that they have, and that's why it takes so long. But, people will look at that and say, I can't believe they just left. They put us all in danger. But they're not really doing that. They're getting information. And that's where behind the scenes, those conversations, the information they're getting back and forth with the individual inside the residence leads them to make those decisions.
It's really interesting stuff. And Gary McNamara, I always appreciate having you come on the show and giving us perspective, whether it is on a college campus or in this situation from your past life as a police officer for 30 years and seeing these kinds of situations play out from the front lines and as a chief. So I appreciate you giving us that perspective this morning and for calling back after calling in yesterday. I really appreciate it.
You got it, Melissa. Thanks for always having the conversation. It's always good to learn. We all need to learn about what our public police officers and other responders do. So thanks for always bringing those discussions to the forefront.
I couldn't agree with you more, Gary. It's actually one of my favorite things about this job is I get to learn so much. It's not even me putting that information out there to people. It's that I also have the opportunity of educating myself as well, because I know I've never put a uniform on. So I appreciate learning and I appreciate your time.
You got it, Melissa. Thanks. Be well.
All right. You too. That is Gary McNamara here on WICC.
Melissa in the Morning talks with career strategist and workplace expert Julie Bauke. It's Julie on the Job. Now on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Oh boy. According to the New York Times, a growing number of young workers now think business casual means wearing things like crop tops to work. So I have to be real with you guys. When I went from TV to radio, let me just say my wardrobe choices went downhill real fast. I wasn't wearing crop tops, but I certainly I did wear like shorts, for example, into the studio. And my sweet PD, you know, said to me, he's like, hey, unless it's like really hot and we don't have the air conditioning working or something, you can't really wear that. You can't do that in case we have clients who come in. And so, like I said, when I was in TV, you know, we had the glitz, the glamour, the dresses, the everything. And then when I started sitting in a studio with four walls around me during COVID, I kind of came in wearing sweatpants and things like that. But I've slowly obviously realized that it's just not appropriate. But it is interesting, Julie, because I do think there's a little bit of a shift with the generations entering the workplace and what is considered appropriate for work and what's not. So I think this is an interesting topic. Good morning.
Good morning. It is. And you're right. There's so many generational there's a big generation gap, let's just say,
yeah,
in terms of what's acceptable to wear at work. And then you're right. The last couple of years, everybody slid.
Right.
But it's about, like you said, it's about knowing what's appropriate in your surroundings at the time. And it's taking note of that and it's responding to that. And it's, you know, this sort of this, well, it's just not me and I don't want to have to buy any extra clothes. And, you know, remember, Gen Z is 22 to 25 right now. Their ages, they're very young. And it's something that, you know, it's just about appropriate for your surroundings. So, for instance, you know, I mean, I remember when I started working, this was so long ago, obviously, but we as women, we really tried to dress like men. You know, we wore those floppy bow ties and it was always pantyhose. And, you know, so that changed. And mm-hmm. So the pendulum will swing. And dear Lord, let's never go back to that. But there, you know, I mean, you look at what's acceptable inside of a bank, let's say, or an insurance company, or a very conservative type of culture or workplace is different than, let's say, a marketing firm that everybody's 30, 35 and under. So there are differences inside of differences. And so the first thing you have to do is, first of all, be aware of your surroundings. If you're young or you walk into a new company, just like you did, you walked in and someone, you know, pulled you aside and said, ixnay on the shorts. You know, you have to note what's going on around you, what's acceptable, and you have to operate within those boundaries. If you aren't willing to do that, you know, then maybe you need to find another place to work, because crop tops, you know, I
just don't know when that's going to be appropriate. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know when that's going to be appropriate. Like the thing that happened with me that I thought was interesting, and I was like, oh, well, thank you so much for the heads up. And maybe I'm a little archaic, which is why I love having this segment on, because I think you're like really hip, Julie, and you kind of keep me in the know. Is it archaic for companies to give a dress code out? And the reason I say that is because literally the way our stations work, and I like it. I get it. I understand it because it's the image of the station. So, for example, you know, Connoisseur owns multiple stations. Most of them are all right here in this building. So you've got kind of more we've got one station that kind of attracts more of like the moms, the working moms. So like, you know, the guys are more casual, but they've got like the sweater vest sort of thing going on. And then you've got the rock station, where if they want to wear their favorite rock, you know, t-shirt with like jeans, that's totally appropriate. But because I'm a news station and people are relying on me to be like a news advocate and, you know, in this like authoritative voice, they don't want to see me in a blouse with jean shorts. They just don't want to. They'd rather see me at least in jeans with like nice shoes and in like a nice top or something. Like that's just sort of the image they see with my show. So I thought, oh, okay, I see. You want me to match what people would perceive this show as being, kind of a thing. And I said, could you just make us like a dress code? And they said the issue with that is, A, it's archaic. Nobody listens to it. But B, it varies from like talent to talent, department to department. Like if you go to our sales department, the women are dressed to the T's. You know, they've got the dresses on, the heels, you know. So it's hard to do that. But is it archaic for companies to give dress codes?
You know, it is, but exactly because of what you were told. There's so many variations, and what they're asking for people to use is their judgment.
Mm.
And that's where sometimes things fall off. So you're right. I think what's most important in what you just said is you are representing your organization. You are representing your department. You're representing your company. They pay you. You are representing them. And they are asking you to use your judgment. They're asking you to use your judgment, look around, and, you know, make good judgment. And we will tell you if you're out of line. Now, what some companies have done, and I've heard this at some of the big companies, they will say, instead of like a firm dress code, their dress code is dress for the day you have, dress for your day. So if you are working at home all day and maybe you have a couple of Zoom calls with coworkers, that's very different than if you're coming into the office or you're going out to meet a client. So the dress codes have gone down to dress for the day you have coming. You know that when you walk into, you know, this whole thing about first impression bias, it's real. It's been around forever. It ain't never going away.
Mm.
And so when we see, if you walked, let's say that you had a very serious, let's say you were sued or you had a very serious, you know, you needed a lawyer for something that was very serious. And the person walked in sweats, tatted up, earrings, you know, nose ring, et cetera. I don't care if this person, you know, this person might be the best lawyer in town. But the first impression that you have when you see this person, you know, you as an attorney in that example, do you really want people to have to fight past that first impression
the
they
bias.
Got of you? Because this like, you know, this sort of this, well, it should just matter how I do on the job. That's all wonderful in fantasy land, but that's not how life works. I mean, we make judgments. If you walk in and your new doctor walks in and they're wearing a white coat and it's all stained, well, now what? You know, what are you like, ooh? You know,
question their cleanliness.
Right?
You question if they care about the job. Yeah, yeah. Well, because you have to go from the client perspective. I see what you're saying. So it's not even necessarily, you know, how your company views you. It's, okay, if we have clients who are coming in, how do they view you? And will you land the job with them? Because it's not a matter of if we know your heart and how great you are. If they don't book you for the job, then nobody's going to know. Right. No one's going to know how good you are. Right.
And then I can hear someone saying, well, I never see clients. Okay. But you are working inside of an organization with human beings. Do you want to grow, be promoted, move around, have opportunities in that organization? So it's not just how good you are at what you do. I mean, it'd be lovely if that was all life was. But it's not, you could be the greatest. So here's an example that is not dress code related, but it's judgment related. So let's say you're 25, you come in every Monday and tell everybody who listed about how drunk you got all weekend. You tell me that the powers that be are going to put you on a hot project?
Right.
Because that is such bad judgment that what if you're on this, you know, this project with a bunch of senior level people in your organization and you start every Monday morning meeting with how drunk you got?
Mm.
You know,
they're going to now question you for even wanting to put them in that position.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
That's a good point.
And So
Julie, I want to talk a little bit more about this, especially because, you know, I know the pandemic is something that we can lean on the fact that like people were working from home. So we kind of moved to sweats a little bit. But also it does seem like there's a generational difference in what is seen as appropriate, even when you go to stores and what they are selling as being appropriate for business attire. So we're talking about wardrobes when it comes to the workplace and how it has changed a lot from generation to generation. And Julie, I noticed for myself when I was working in television, you know, that's a very strict dress code. They still send dress codes out for TV because you have to be in, you know, bold colors, no patterns, you know, certain length for dresses, so on and so forth. And when I remember shopping for my wardrobe for television, and it was hard because, you know, when I went to most what I'd call business attire stores, it's very pattern. It's very distracting. The length is not anywhere near as long as it used to be. And it's very, it's just not what I think a lot of stores used to sell. I think that stores have also started to shift to kind of a, if you want to call it like sexier business attire look. I don't know if you can comment on that at all. Of course, I'm not going to pull certain stores out and really, you know, point that out. But I do think we've also sort of slid what the appropriateness and what the level, like the standard has been. I think that's kind of slipped on a retail level overall as well. Would you agree?
So sidebar, I have a question. Did you have to wear dresses?
You didn't have to, but I have a weird body stature. Like I have a I have a longer torso. My legs are the same length as my arms, just to give you a perspective. Okay. So when I wear pantsuits, it looks ridiculous. So you didn't have to wear dresses. No, okay. I wear like skirts and dresses.
I see that. Yeah. And we have friends in news media and they're always like giving each other in TV.
Oh, and you trade dresses and stuff?
Clues.
Yeah. You
have
to.
Yeah, like, hey, or go check out the store. They just got a bunch of, you know, it does seem like it. And I just, you know, and this is where I start to feel like, you know, an old boomer, you know, the first thing people see about you is it's these first impression stuff. It's not just what you say, but it's what you wear. And Melissa, this is entirely personal opinion. And I know I'm going to get, you know, I know that there'd be a lot of people who would disagree. But as a woman, if you are dressing very sexy in the workplace, like extremely plunging necklines, very short skirts, that is the first thing. Is my son said this when he was 16 about girls who dressed leaving nothing to the imagination. Mm-hmm. Literally, he was 16 and he said, "Well, you know what they think their best quality is." And he goes, it's not their brain.
I don't disagree with him fully. I mean, I don't. Yeah. I can remember being in TV and being so mad because I took the dress code seriously and I was a young reporter. I started at 21 years old. I was a one-man band. I was going out with all these seasoned professionals. And I'm like, who the heck am I? And I can remember being like at hospitals. I can remember distinctly, Julie Bauke, being at a hospital once, and there was this big new surgical thing that they were doing, and they let one of the other competing stations, they let her come in and watch the procedure being done live, and they would not let me come in, and I was so angry. And when I called my news director about it, the first thing he said was, he goes, please don't take offense to this, but what was she wearing? And I said, well, and I took a picture of her. And I sent it, and he goes, yeah, that's why they let her in. And it was so infuriating, but it's true. Like, in some regards, it's like, oh, okay, so you dress sexy to get the job, but at the same time, like, I don't want to be known for that. I don't want you to think I'm a good reporter because I dressed, you know, that way. So, yeah, I don't disagree with your son. I don't know.
I think
you're kind of putting that out there.
I was talking to a friend of mine who was talking about this woman that they hired at his company, and she's very, very high up. And she's probably in her 50s and dresses, he said it's dresses extremely sexy, like very inappropriate for the workplace. And he said the people who are the most upset about it are the other women, especially the younger women look at her and say, wow, you know, this is not a good role model. This is not how we want to be perceived. We think she's making women in this company, you know,
she's making standard
harder for us.
Yeah.
To be taken seriously. And these are younger women who are saying that. And so it's, you know, I'm all for, you have to manage your own brand. You have to manage your reputation, the perception of you in the workplace. You know, that is what we all have to do. And you have to decide what you want to be perceived. You have to decide what you want people to see or hear or think when they listen to you in a meeting. And we all have the ability and the opportunity to manage that reputation. What do you want to be known for? Do you want to be known for your short skirts and your plunging necklines? Or do you want to be known for your work? It's, unfortunately, we live in a world where it's hard for both of those things. It's hard to be taken extremely seriously if you show up wearing clothes it looks like you would wear to a nightclub. And that, I'm sorry it makes me sound old, but I think that is still true, and I think it will always be true.
Yeah, it's interesting because I remember having this conversation with my husband when he first, you know, when we first got our new jobs here in Connecticut, and he's like, it's kind of weird, like the company I work for now, like they don't require ties. And I'm like, if that's the hardest thing you've got to deal with is do I wear a tie or not? Like,
oh my gosh,
man, just put it in your briefcase. You're going to be fine. Like, I have to bring a whole wardrobe and figure out what the heck I got to wear. So
they do have it a lot easier.
Men have it a lot easier than the women do. I will say they have it a lot easier than they do. And he still packs a tie because he's like, I never know if a client's coming in, I throw the tie on. I'm like, it must be nice. I don't know.
Yeah.
it's something.
You know, do you have time for one more quick story?
One quick story, yes.
Yeah. So a friend of mine was telling me a story about how he was a young guy who went to work for an investment bank. And so obviously everybody dresses really, really well. Mm-hmm. But there was one guy who dressed better. than everybody else, including all the bosses. And he said he was looked down upon, too, because he didn't read the room. He didn't read the clues. And so he was dressing in extremely expensive, very, very like top of the line clothes. But he was dressing better than the people above him. And so it was almost like there was a target on his back immediately. It's sort of like, who does he think he is? And so, you know, you have to read the room. You have to know what's appropriate for where you are in an organization, what your role is, and what do people above you dress like. You know, it's an old saying that's don't dress for the job you have, dress for the job you want.
Yeah,
and
that's very true.
That is, right? And that is, so you look at not only what do people in your, you know, that are your level wear, what do they wear? What do the people above you wear? What's considered acceptable? And, you know, it's I think in this post-COVID thing, this hybrid workforce life.
Oh, that made it a lot harder. That's
right?
That's for sure.
That's why I like the saying, dress for the job, dress for your day.
Yeah, I do like that too. Julie Bauke, we've run out of time, but I always appreciate you. Thank you so much.
See you next week.
Sounds good. Julie on the job here on WICC.